session number 6818, room 9.
No.
General Moulton, Reel 9. How did you actually divide up the beaches? Did you just put them in roughly equal lengths?
No, I don't think the length the beach came into it. It's a continuous sandy beach from east of La Panne to Dunkirk. La Panne made a sort of central point for one core sector, not necessarily first core. Bredoun for another core sector, and Dunkirk for the third. But whether we were thinking in terms of the mole at Dunkirk, which eventually, of course, the great majority of the BEF came embarked by the mole, or whether we were thinking of beach embarkation, I rather think that we were thinking in terms of beach embarkation, but it would have been from the eastern side of Dunkirk.
Had you any idea of how you would actually get the troops taken off the beaches?
Well, I suppose we were obviously expecting beach embarkation, and I suppose we were hoping for the Navy to arrange something.
Well, Navy would just bring cutters in and out.
We had no contact with the Navy except through Whitehall at that stage.
There's no naval liaison officer at La Panne.
At that time, there was no liaison, no naval liaison officer at La Panne.
What about controlling the movement of the troops into these evacuation areas?
Well, we thought the idea would have been that each corps would have a control centre to control the section of beach allotted to it, and then they would detail the units to embark.
Did you make any estimate of how many men you could get out per day?
No, I think I'd have been too gloomy altogether.
So you weren't very optimistic about the prospects of evacuating?
I think we'd really got into a state of mind of not thinking too far ahead.
Just partly because of the fatigue?
Well, we was no larger because we got so used to, certainly at GHQ level, we were so used to seeing arrows on our maps which showed German tanks were right round behind us that one really just... It was better not to think what might happen tomorrow. Mm. I remember reading in one of the biographies of General Alexander that he used to keep a map in his battle dress pocket so if it came to the worst, he could know where to make his getaway. I mean, the whole thing collapsed. He was going to escape as an individual. Well, until now, until I read that, I've been rather ashamed of the fact that's just what I did. But I used to keep in my battle dress pocket a fairly small-scale map, a certain... least knowing which direction to walk if a threat came. And that was the only way. It was a very good introduction to shooting war, not to always be thinking about the future, just be fatalistic about it.
How long did you have to get these arrangements made before the evacuation commenced?
I probably could find out by looking at the official histories, but I don't think I would call 3 or 4 days.
So you were, you did have time to get things sorted out.
We had time, but whether we had, to what extent we had the resources to get things sorted out was another matter.
What sort of resources do you need?
I do remember a good bit of moving about myself on odd jobs I was given to do around the beach here.
What sort of odd jobs?
Well, the one was to find the chief signal officer in Dunkirk, probably finding people and asking for things like that.
What arrangements could be made for receiving the troops on the outskirts of these evacuation areas?
Well, one thing, of course, as you know, it's in all the histories and was obvious, that we did, in the British zone, we had a perimeter at which vehicles were stopped. I remember seeing the queue of vehicles that formed up there, the three wide, the three deep, and stretching right back. The extraordinary thing is, I passed them going out somewhere to Berg or something like that, and there they all were. I thought, well, what's going to happen to this lot under air attack? And when I came back, they had been attacked, but there were only a few clumps. It was nothing like the strike that could have been mounted in 1944.
So would you say the effect of air attack that time was more psychological than physical?
It would be rather too hard a line to draw, that I think. But undoubtedly, there was a lot of psychological element in it. And it was remarkable how troops, once they got used to it, were able to accept it. And really, if a man dug in a slit trench, there wasn't much danger from a Stuka tear.
Who actually worked out the routes by which the columns were to come into these reception areas at the perimeter? Was that left to Corps headquarters?
I really don't remember. I think it would be a fairly simple thing to arrange. And of course, it would have to be arranged with the forward headquarters of Primorsk, or wherever they were by then, who were controlling the withdrawal, as well as ourselves. I think probably we gave them points to reach and left it to the forward headquarters to get them there.
Now, you said that GHQ eventually arrived at La Panne.
I said what?
GHQ eventually arrived at La Panne.
At La Panne, yeah.
Yeah. Now, when did that happen? How long had you been there when the rest of the headquarters turned
they
up?
They certainly weren't there on the first night of the embarkation. And they were there. Perhaps I take that in sequence. On the first night of the embarkation, three sloops arrived, quite small ships. They arrived off the beaches with no idea where the troops were, and all they had to get them off the beaches was one motorboat and one 27-foot whaler per sloop. I went out to meet the first whaler in. There was a strong tidal current. I know enough about beaches to know the boat needs help from the shore, the beach under those conditions. So I waded out with some of the chaps there, and Sub-Lieutenant R&R on the stern sheets probably fired a revolver over my head. He thought he was going to be swamped by panic-stricken troops. So I managed to calm him down a bit, and eventually went off and saw the captain. I got them moved up towards one of the Corps embarkation points. But after a bit, the captain, I think very reasonably, said that it was very shallow water and he there were a lot of troops about, and he wasn't going to risk his ships by further movement. Mm. So he dropped his anchor again, and he got off what he could. How many could he expect to get off with that amount of embarkation? So I went back to La Panne and saw General Adams. I remember sort of salt water and sand dripping off my battle dress trousers, and I said, well, this is not going to work. And he rang up on, I think he talked to Churchill. I thought so at the time. I had no reason they didn't. And when it was all out, I said, well, look, I'm sure the Navy could do better than this. If anyway, some tell them what was wanted, can I go back to Dover and see what I can do? He's very reluctant to let me go. We may have thought I got the wind up, but and then I went, and I slept way across in one of these sloops and got ashore, went up to some sort of area army headquarters, who had much idea about anything, and then eventually got into Admiral Ramsay's underground headquarters and up in the Dover Cliffs. The staff there all seemed mainly concerned with getting together the little ships of Dunkirk. They had very precious little idea of what they're going, giving them any firm orders what to do. They eventually saw the Admiral and pointed. I had a map with the core embarkation points marked on it and showed it to everyone I could, but it was obvious I wasn't doing any good at all. And so I caught a destroyer, and halfway across that destroyer turned back because they were modern fleet destroyers and they didn't want to lose them all. And then I caught another one and embarked, came ashore to Bredouin, walked up to La Panne, and by that time the GHQ had taken over at La Panne.
Had
so that was probably after two or three days of the embarkation. Yes, sorry.
Was there any means of communication between the troops on the beach and the ships?
No. Well, I mean, rowing out in a boat, say hello, but...
you couldn't practice visual signalling with lamps or anything like that? Then.
Well, there were a few junior naval officers on the beach. I dare say they did have lamp signal. Mm. Pretty little idea of what to say, I think.
Mm. What were the beaches like when you got back from your visit to Dover?
There were a few dead bodies lying about, a certain amount of oil along the waterfront. There was a French destroyer, many pictures of her were badly hit by bombs. I think the oil was coming out of her. And it's quite a lot of wrecked ships, boats and things. I say one or two naval officers, one of the troubles they had, nothing much seemed to have been done about from administering, seeing they got food and rest and so on. There's all terror scenes of Dunkirk beaches. Well, they seem to pass me by. I don't remember. I do remember air attack, but that was going on. Okay. But I don't remember any terrible Holocaust there.
Were there a lot of troops on the beach?
In the dunes, a little way back, yes.
But they weren't on the open beach, they were...
Well, they had no reason to be on the open beach. Except there are these pictures of queues formed up there. I suppose they must have been there, but...
Were there any Belgian and French troops?
There were some
beach?
French officers. I remember that first night, someone drove a car and began flashing their headlights to seaward. That's what they thought they were doing. I don't know, but... But mainly, of course, the main French beaches were the other side of Dunkirk.
What were the troops actually doing in the dunes? Were they just lying up and waiting?
Were they waiting their turn?
Were they generally under control and in
well, there were quite a lot of units coming under control as units. There were also quite a lot of loose men, so to speak. We really put them down to some of the railroad services and so on. There undoubtedly were some deserters, I suppose. I don't really know.
And what could be done for them in the way of administration for food and...
I suppose the units had their own resources. Battalion has its own resources for administration. There must have been some arrangements for food dumps to draw their food from. The sort of loose men, I dare say, found someone to get some. They didn't seem particularly starving.
A lot of people say that the main problem at Dunkirk was not food so much as water that they couldn't get.
I never noticed that, actually. It has never occurred to me. I mean, in La Penne, there seemed to be a tap or something, and I never remember being worried about it.
What did you do once you got back to La Panne?
What
did you do once you got back to
La
Panne?
Well, I reported to... I was joined up again with the main part of op section. It's got the usual routine of watchkeeping and so on. And then that began to get rather... Well, it didn't seem to be much to do. It actually could do. I spent one night working on the beaches, where I thought I'd make myself useful. There were some lifeboats stranded on the beach, which had a lever action to work a screw. And the 12th Lancers, who everyone had done admirably all through the campaign, and their last job was to police the beaches. And I found a sergeant there, and we got some chaps hanging around, and as the tide came in, we shoved one of these liners into the water, and we filled up with troops. Come on, get them, boys, want to get off. Gave an example of how to work these levers and headed for... There was an old anti-aircraft, old cruiser lying out there, one of the C-class cruisers, I think, and took our first load out. And so then I said, last six men stay in the boat to bring them back, which they did. Much like being told to stay in, but they did it. And so we took her back and got another load, and after a bit we said last four men out. I think we got down to last two men we kept to help us in. And in fact, I'm not sure, I don't know how we got back. Oh yes, we ran out of traps in the end, and came the dawn, so to speak, and we'd had a good long night of it, and we'd kind of got off quite a lot. So, well, there we were. What to do next? Was able to hand a boat over to, and I tied her up to one of those lorries, you know, those sort of pair of things, and I couldn't see any. There seemed to be no more troops ready to come. I went back to the op section.
How was the movement of troops onto the beach and into the little boats regulated?
There must have been regulation points, I think. I mean, a lot of the fighting troops were, of course, fighting on the defence line. There was a perimeter defence on a canal there, Renkenberg. And I think really what I can imagine happening would be that when the turn came, when a unit got orders to embark, it was told where to go through, and through the usual channels.
You say that
this was left. This was in the core sectors, you see, so I wasn't actually concerned with that beyond initially trying to get some link between the Navy and the Army on where the embarkation points were to be.
What was GHQ's main concern then when you got back? Was it simply to get the perimeter set up on the rest?
Well, it
of the
had
army
a dual
out.
Concern. One was to the perimeter defence, and the other was to continue the embarkation, which gradually, as the figures show, centred more and more on the mole at Dunkirk.
And I think you say that GHQ itself went out through the mole.
Yeah. Well, that was when Gort was ordered by Churchill to withdraw, and that morning, I think, of the 31st of May, and after a bit, junior staff and clerks and people were ordered to make their way towards the mole and embark. We had a sapper major, one of the G2s, Arthur Dove, who was in charge of that party, and we eventually got down to where the mole joins the seafront. And then there was a call. They were having trouble controlling traffic. Somebody said, "Are there any staff officers in your party?" And Arthur Dow was a very conscientious man. Of course, he owned up. And so I spent that day on the mole directing troops. Again, a lot of the time it was a constant stream of people coming down, and one just had to try and get them on the ships quickly. There was a lot of French First Army coming through. They took grave offence, so they wanted to try and do it in a rather stately way, preserving their military organisation. Well, it just wasn't on. I remember a French colonel being very angry with me when I told him he must get his troops into that ship and not keep them hanging about on the mole. The mole was getting a little bit of shell fire, not very effective, actually. And, of course, there were occasional air attacks with the ships firing back, got rather noisy. And then by that evening, everything seemed to be stopping the traffic, so nobody seemed to want many more, so I went to... All the others had gone, so I went to the naval headquarters. I said, "Well, do you want me here anymore?" And didn't seem to want them, so I got on board the destroyer. And
how did you actually move from La Panne down to Dunkirk?
Was walked.
That, you walked all the way?
I think it was all the way. Some of the way, certainly. We just possibly got some lift some of the way.
How long did it take you?
Oh, I don't know. Not all that way. I mean, it's I can't really remember the exact time.
What sort of ship did you get onto eventually?
A destroyer. And again, one just got down and slept for the passage.
So you don't remember anything of the voyage back?
Of the one?
You don't
very little.
Anything, no.
Well, I do remember one thing. We had seen the first assault landing craft as we steamed out. Oh, before the war, when I was at Staff College, there were the mock-ups were available at Portsmouth, and we saw them. And there, I thought, well, these would be bloody useful if we'd had them on the beach. And as we steamed out, there was one of them, tied up to a buoy well out to sea, quite empty. I suppose she'd probably run out of fuel.
Where did you fetch up when you got back to
Dover?
Back into Dover. And what happened to you?
One got in a train, and people handed in soft drinks and things, and one steamed off, and I eventually fetched up somewhere on Salisbury Plain. And after a bit, I was told I'd go home, more or less, and leave an address. My wife was with her parents down in just outside Plymouth, so I went down. I must have got a railway pass to get down there. And then eventually I was recalled to join GHQ, which was in London at the time.
Was that GHQ Home Forces?
No, that was GHQ BEF, who were engaged in writing the dispatch for the thing. I didn't take much part in that, actually.
Do you think there are any major lessons that you learned on the campaign that were valuable?
Well, I would say that one's teaching at Cambly had been pretty sound, really. As I think I said earlier, many people said afterwards some of the scenes were just like a telephone battle at Cambly, and in fact, vice versa, some of the incidents were embodied in future telephone battles at Cambly. I think the staff doctrine was pretty sound at Cambly. One need hardly say on a broader issue the helplessness of a purely infantry army. I mean, Brian Bond gave a lecture at the RUSI called The Myths of Dunkirk. It seemed to me he thought the myth of Dunkirk he missed altogether was that the idea of a British counterattack south was absolute bloody nonsense. It just couldn't have worked. I mean, some people have said that the poor quality German infantry were following their armour. I don't know. German infantry aren't usually of poor quality, and there's absolutely no evidence to the point that those were low. They may have been low grade, but after all, Norway was captured by 7th Vela, whatever that stands for, Echelon, I suppose, infantry. The German infantry are all right. The German soldiers are very good, and the idea that there was a soft sort of underbelly or way through behind the German army was pure fiction. That was the myth of Dunkirk. I mean, some of the other things he trotted out were well-known facts, such as the fact most people got out of the mole, not the little ships. Well, surely everyone's known that for the last 30 years. But that is the myth that people freeze onto. Now, I'm a great admirer of the French in many ways, and the French army too, but don't treat them as kids. I mean, don't pretend that they didn't make a nonsense there. They did, and they know it. And I admire the French for Leclerc, not for Gamelin. And there's this modern school of thought which tries to pretend it was all the British fault. Well, if the British could have produced a well-balanced force of 20 or 30 divisions, okay, well, maybe we ought to have done. There's nothing we could do about that by 1940. Chance had passed, and we lacked the ability to. Our armour was much too weak, and the first armoured division, remember, wasn't should have come out long ago, long before that, and should have been organised and commanded with far more drive and impetus in order to get not in the fighting, but to get the thing there. We paid the penalty, really, for all those ladies with green flags imitating anti-tank guns in the exercises on Salisbury Plain.
When were you actually sent off to Sandhurst to run the liaison school?
Well, I wasn't wanted to help write the dispatch, and I went, on whose initiative, I don't know, I went to the Royal Marine Reserve Depot, which was training National Servicemen, at Limston, which is now the Commando Training Centre. I was there a week, and they had a very live wire, retired lieutenant colonel, who had a fine fighting record in World War I. He was the only person who was at all interested in anything I might have learned there. He was training young officers and insisted I should give a lecture on my experiences and lessons at Dunkirk. I found I had to divide into two, one about the Phoney War and one about the real war. And I'd just given the one on the Phoney War, where I found I was appointed to take command of the liaison school to train motor contact officers based on the Marchant House at Sandhurst, which was to be doubled in intake, and various people joined me and we got on with it. But then I said, well, I'm going to give my second lecture there. So I did drive down to give my second lecture to the young officers there, and from then on I was very heavily engaged. One thing I've always regretted was that I thought of it and never did it. About half our intake of junior officers would have had served in the BEF in regimental jobs. I always thought I ought to put them in a room and said, now write your experiences. Because one had fascinating stories about it all. It confirmed my feeling that the British soldiers did very well. This denigration of defeat, it was a defeat, but it wasn't the fault of the fighting soldiers, nor of Gort. I think it's a remarkable thing that Gort happened to be just the right chap in the right place. I don't suppose he might not have been much good commanding the 8th Army in the desert, but for that particular thing, task, he was exactly the right man. I mean, among other things, he had to disobey orders to order retreat. Well, if you've got to do such a job as that, it's a great help to have a famous VC. At least nobody can accuse you of funk. It was remarkable how that man, in that particular situation, was absolutely built to fit him, and he was built to fit it.
What was the main sort of thing you're trying to teach your motor contact officers when you're running?
Well, you ran a sort of junior, very compressed staff course. We had 8 weeks course. They had to be taught to ride a motorcycle, and they had to be taught to understand a brigade operation order and be able to carry a situation report. They had to be something about the organization of the army. You were getting them out of the sort of purely regimental look of things into the formation level.
Were they all subalterns?
Nearly all subalterns. And about half of each course. Perhaps the third course had less than half, but first two, I say, were at least half had served in... about half had served in Dunkirk business.
And their role was to be simply to keep headquarters
To take messages, orders, or whatever, to a lower headquarters. And this had... apparently been one of the lessons of the German invasion of Poland, and this liaison school had been started in the autumn of 1939 to train these people, and now they were very useful. We had three attached to the Alps section, and they did some very good work, and